This week on Making Contact.
So he took off his gun and his vest, and the first question he asked is, what happened to you? And I said, what happened to you?
And we work with these countries to use torture for what we think is our own gain.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three courageous human rights advocates. Palestinian-American Huwaida Araf created the International Solidarity Movement. Maria Lahoud is a U.S.-based attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing survivors of torture. And Argentinian Patricia Isasa is bringing to justice those who detained and tortured her. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. Huwaida Araf likes to say she was conceived in Palestine and born in the United States. Her parents immigrated to the U.S. shortly before her birth, hoping to raise their children without the upheaval of occupation and war. Even though Huwaida grew up in the U.S., she says her family maintained deep ties to relatives and culture in the Middle East.
We used to go back when I was a little bit younger, almost every 1 or 2 years, because all of our family were there. We were kind of alone in the United States, minus 1 or 2 relatives. But we went back in 1986, and that was the last time. We were so abused and humiliated at the airport and detained and strip searched. Even me as a child remember, you know, being taken with my sisters and with my mother in a room and strip searched. After that, my father did not want to take us back anymore. Growing up, I really didn't even know any Jews. It was only when, as a young girl, we would go back to Palestine and in the occupied territories, I would see Jewish soldiers. That was the extent of my exposure to Jews. But at the University of Michigan, I had a lot of people that lived on my floor as a freshman that were Jewish American, and I became friends with them on a non-political level. But it was when one of them said to me, "Isn't Israel great?" And I'm like, "No, Israel is not great." And that started me thinking that I should probably try to get into politics and diplomacy, because there was obviously a rift between us politically, and there had to be some way to bridge that rift if approached in a certain way. And that got me into studying more the politics of the Middle East. I started studying Hebrew and Judaic studies, as well as improving my formal written and spoken Arabic. And then I went to study in Jerusalem.
At the University of Michigan, Huwaida started an Arab-Jewish dialogue group. In Jerusalem, in the year 2000, she worked in conflict resolution prior to the Second Intifada.
I went to work for a program that brought together Israeli youth and Palestinian youth in order to dialogue with each other and break down those stereotypes or those walls of hatred that are built up from misunderstanding the other side. But I couldn't ignore what was happening around me. Almost every week, I would get an alert about a Palestinian home that was somewhere around our offices that was being threatened with demolition. Being in the Palestinian areas of Jerusalem and witnessing how Israeli soldiers would treat Palestinians is just a very discriminatory policy that became so blatant to me. You couldn't ignore it. And then on September 29th, the second Palestinian Intifada broke out. And I found myself not able to continue working, not because I was turning my back on dialogue or no longer thought it was important. Dialogue is still very important, but that's for long-term change. I very much believe that people also need to take to the streets. People need to put their bodies where their hearts and minds or where their words are. So I resigned as I became more involved in active nonviolent resistance to Israeli occupation. And the Israeli military, police, and security forces came at us with their M16s and later came at us with their armored personnel carriers with their tanks. And they were, again, opening fire on unarmed protesters. Within the first month, by the end of October 2000, 144 Palestinian protesters had been shot dead.
and thousands injured, and those injuries were from bullet wounds to the chest and head area. At the same time, the mainstream media, because I would watch CNN or these different media outlets that I grew up with, they were not accurately portraying what was happening on the ground. In fact, they were blaming the Palestinians, saying the Palestinians turned their back on this peace process and decided to adopt a violent resistance. And that wasn't what was happening at all. So it was a very disempowering feeling for most of the people. There had to be something else. And that's where the idea for the International Solidarity Movement came. Palestinians needed resources. I didn't think it was bullets or arms that we needed, but we needed good people from around the world to stand with us, to come with us on our protests, to provide witness and even protective accompaniment when we faced off with Israeli soldiers. We needed international civilians to help get our story out, to help convince the mainstream media that we weren't out to push the Israelis or the Jews into the sea. This wasn't even a Palestinian, Israeli, or a Muslim, Jewish conflict. It was, and it is, a conflict of freedom versus occupation.
The International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, draws allies from all over the world, ordinary people whose peaceful presence can help diffuse the daily violence of life in a war zone. Volunteers monitor trouble at checkpoints, accompany the sick and injured in ambulances, nonviolently resist the demolition of Palestinian homes and orchards, and provide humanitarian aid wherever possible. During the 5-week siege of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem in 2002, ISM brought food and other humanitarian aid to 200 people who had taken refuge in the church. Braving a confrontation with Israeli soldiers, ISM volunteers delivered the supplies, but Hueda and others were arrested.
Actually, something very strange happened on that day also. As we were pulled out of Nativity Square and they were trying to drag us into this building away from the cameras that were filming what was happening, and we all sat down. There were about 13 of us. We sat down and refused to go. And we all linked arms, and then I heard a voice from above me saying, "You have to go, Hueda. This isn't the University of Michigan anymore." And I looked up. To my dismay, in a soldier's uniform was one of my former classmates who had studied Arabic with me, who I had attended various Jewish functions together with, and we were friends at the time and had some very interesting and productive conversation. The soldiers ended up dragging us into the building where they aimed to get us and isolated and interrogated us for about 7 hours after that. And at one point, this young man tried to come in. Apparently, he was also affected and he wanted to talk to me. And I told him that I wasn't going to talk to him as long as he was wearing that gun. And so he took off his gun and his vest and sat down to talk to me. And the first question he asked is, "What happened to you?" And I said, "What happened to you?"
One of the people moved to respond to the ISM's call for support was Rachel Corey, a 23-year-old peacemaker from Olympia, Washington, who was killed by an Israeli Army bulldozer operator in 2003 while trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home.
Unfortunately, definitely my loss. I never met Rachel personally. The time that she came to Palestine, I had just left to do some speaking engagements in the United States. And I remember being in Boston for an event when I received a phone call from an Arab journalist in London who wanted to make sure that I was okay. He said, "I just heard on the wire that an American peace activist has been killed, and I thought it was you." That's where the first news came from, and it was your worst nightmare come true. Rachel wasn't Muslim, she wasn't Palestinian, she wasn't Arab, wasn't even Jewish. I'm sure she quickly realized how dangerous the situation was and that nobody was safe. And yet that human connection was important to her. And she stayed. And on the day that she was killed, she faced off with an Israeli soldier sitting behind an armored bulldozer And she was trying to communicate with him and convince him that it was wrong to demolish the home that she was trying to protect, which was the home of a Palestinian pharmacist that she had been staying with. Rachel's legacy lives on it. And I feel that she, as if she lives on in me, certainly. And I know in us all, the people, the very, very wonderful people that I've had the privilege of working with, Palestinians and internationals from around the world.
For Huwaida, the Middle East conflict, as complex as it is, has been made even more nuanced by her marriage to a Jewish American.
I am married to a wonderful man by the name of Adam Shapiro, who is not Palestinian, who is from a Jewish family, a wonderful family at that. They accepted me with no question from the very beginning. But we were attacked a lot by the really fanatic or right-wing pro-Israel community, mainly in the United States. They called Adam a traitor, a self-hating Jew, a Jewish terrorist, or the Jewish Taliban. The day after our wedding, there were headlines like sleeping with the enemy. But, you know, some of these attacks, which still continue not only on us personally, but on the work that we're doing in the international solidarity movement in an attempt to vilify us, discredit or silence us, they only give us that much more incentive to keep going, because this is the kind of hatred and ignorance that we're trying to overcome.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like to hear more information, or for a cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Born and raised in Peoria, Illinois, Maria LaHood says that even as a child, she was driven by a burning sense of justice. She decided to become a lawyer to effect social change, joining the Center for Constitutional Rights as a lead attorney and an advocate for detainees who've been tortured.
There's many ways we could talk about human rights and all the various human rights. And I mean, the one I think that CCR has been working on most directly is the issue of executive power and the fact that the Bush administration has been taking more and more power for itself and away from the judiciary, so that there are no checks and balances on its behavior. So that since 9/11, the government rounded up Arab and South Asian Muslim men because of their religion and their ethnicity, and detained them until they had been clears of ties to terrorism. And then it extended into the international arena, where we, without any due process, perform things like extraordinary renditions, kidnapping people in other countries and sending them to third countries to be tortured and arbitrarily detained. Meher Arar, who was picked up in the United States, who CCR represents, sent to Syria to be tortured. He was kept there for a year, and he's been cleared of any ties to Al-Qaeda, any ties to terrorism. We don't know how many people have been subject to this. There are estimates that range from 150 to thousands. I mean, it's a practice that shows how the U.S. government truly acts outside the law, how it's willing to physically take people outside the law and disappear them in a country that we condemn for their human rights abuses. Our State Department says this country tortures people. That's a violation of their human rights. And we work with these countries to use torture for what we think is our own gain. Meher is really a very courageous man, extremely inspirational. I started to work on his case a couple of years ago. I'll tell his story. He's a Canadian citizen. He was born in Syria. He moved to Canada when he was 17 with his family. Never had been back to Syria, never intended to go back to Syria, hadn't done his military service there. They put him on a private jet plane took him through Maine, through D.C., to Italy. Syria allegedly wouldn't accept him directly, so they took him to Jordan, where he was beaten and interrogated and then driven over the border into Syria. For the first couple of weeks, the physical torture was the worst. He was beaten with an electrical cable and interrogated. He was held in an underground grave for 10 months and 10 days, which was 3 feet by 6 feet by 7 feet. I mean, think of being in a closet for an hour, much less 10 months and 10 days. No daylight, rats, horrible, horrible. How courageous. Not only coming through this horrific year of his life, his relationship with his wife and his children has been dramatically altered. He continues to suffer from the torture and from the ordeal and from the fact that the U.S. government still refuses to acknowledge what they've done to him or that he is an innocent man. He's been unable to achieve justice. He's been unable to find work. His courage in continuing to persevere and pursue justice so that this won't happen to anyone else, so that there's some accountability and that people understand that this is happening to other innocent people. How many people in Guantanamo are innocent? There have been studies done saying that only 8%, this is from the Department of Defense's documents, only 8% are al-Qaeda fighters. So I continue to be inspired by Maher's courage. I was thinking, what would happen if I were kidnapped and detained and tortured in a foreign place, you know, without any access? And I think about how I could even get through that. I don't think I could. But then if I came back home and people said it was my fault, and people said I did something to deserve it, and people refused to apologize or acknowledge it, I can't imagine how hard it would be to actually persevere and fight for justice. And Maher is really amazingly courageous in that way.
CCR's case on behalf of Maher Arar was dismissed on grounds of national security and state secrets. Refusing to give up, Maria and CCR are bringing charges against Donald Rumsfeld and the U.S. government for the torture at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere.
Because the U.S. is unwilling to prosecute any of the high-level officials, CCR is going to Germany to see if another country will do so. It's really part of a wider movement we call universal jurisdiction to hold perpetrators responsible in other places when their own countries won't. Politically, it's very difficult for other countries to stand up to the U.S. government. But I think it's already happening. It's happening with Italy and Germany and other countries who are investigating in the EU, investigating extraordinary renditions. There are arrest warrants out in Italy for maybe 22, 26 CIA people who were involved in an extraordinary rendition there. So I think other countries are getting fed up with our lawless behavior. It's a tool of terror in itself. By torturing a people, they become less human to us. It's a tool to dehumanize someone. It's a tool of control. And maybe somehow they thought that by asserting our power, by asserting our military might, by asserting our ability to make these people less than people, we would be on top. We would regain our power that was being challenged. But can anyone truly believe that it's worth losing our collective soul over?
The Center for Constitutional Rights was the first legal group to represent Guantanamo detainees when no other U.S. lawyers would deal with them. CCR also represents detainees at the Bagram military base and is contesting the legality of the U.S. Military Commissions Act, which strips the basic human rights of prisoners labeled enemy combatants. Maria LaHood reflects on her work with the center and her hopes for the future.
I would like to see high-level government officials held accountable for their violations of law in the U.S. government and elsewhere. I would like to see an apology to Maher Arar, a real apology, and compensation for the losses that he's undergone. whether or not that comes from a court, whether or not the government decides to, for the first time, admit responsibility and accountability and just do the right thing, I think, yeah, it would be great to see Rumsfeld convicted in Germany. It would be great to see officials concerned about the ramifications of their acts, the killing, the torture, the government-sanctioned crimes. I think that would be a good start.
During the 1970s, Latin America was alive with progressive ideas, much like today. Salvador Allende was elected president of Chile. Uruguay, Peru, and Bolivia had also elected progressive leaders. And in Argentina, there was a strong grassroots social movement. Student activists like Patricia, Indiana, y Sasa protested alongside Argentine trade unionists for better working conditions, higher pay, and a more progressive education. 16-year-old Patricia was an honor student chosen to represent her high school at the Students' Union in the province of Santa Fe. There she was kidnapped by the Argentine government, detained and tortured for over 2 years.
When they kidnapped me, and when I watched the cars, a lot of soldiers, different armies, because it's the police and the army and the secret police to free army involved. When I saw in the street, I think, oh, probably they kidnapped another person. But all of this operation is for me to try to make a very important show to kidnap a person to show, well, what happened with an honor student if the one honor student were involved in a politics issues. What happened in U.S. when the activists think, oh, it's possible the military kidnapped me. It is possible when the military kidnapped me, I have a terrible accusation, look like terrorist or subversive. And it is possible to have military trial. And it is possible to spend in jail 20 years. Well, the activists became afraid. Probably stop or think twice the same action. And this is the object. I've been in three concentration camps. It is not in a legal jail. I spent 1 week in a very stressed position. They put me handcuffed in my hands, another handcuffed in my feet. And this is a really, really, really stressed position. Today I have a problem in my leg. I'm 45 years old, 30 years later I have a problem in my left leg. They moved me for another concentration camp. It was a special place when they tortured and they exterminated. They murdered some people in these places. The interrogation, they undressed me. They humiliated me. They raped me. I received sexual abuse. And I was 16 years old. In all of the age, it is terrible. But when you don't have it's my first experience with adult sex. This experience, I think, is worse, definitely worse.
When Patricia was finally released in 1979, she began a process of filing complaints with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. She was kidnapped again, along with some 40 other people. Only Patricia and three others survived. In a long struggle to bring her tormentors to justice, Patricia's investigations led her to the U.S.-run School of the Americas and its legacy of teaching torture.
All of this is amazing. It's more cruel than you can think, than you can imagine. All of this, it is a training with the School of America. How can I say? Because I know the School of America. I found the manual with the School of America near to 20, 23, 25 years later. And it's not only my experience, because I live during all of the period, 2 years and a half, I've been with more than 100 women, and all have the same experience during 2 years and a half. And when you compare my personal experience with the different personal experience with the young people, old people, people who be pregnant, the same. And they capture with the same tactics. They interrogate the same method. This is a training. And who is behind all of this custom? The School of America. And where I can say this? Because I found a lot of orders, signed orders. It is a plan. It is a plan. And behind all the School of America, the person who have the most important responsibility, in my case, is the Domingo Marcellini and the School of America. Because the School of America give a training with him. He probably, when he came in, he was a soldier. But when he came out, he became an assassin, in a cruel man. And I make the search and I found this person. We can say, I found the justice. Because it's totally different. You don't know who abused you, who humiliated you. And when you put a light, you know who is he. And when you know who are these kind of persons, you can to go for the justice and say, well, I found this. It's not a strange dream. It's not a person who stay in the shadow. No, no. This is Eduardo Ramos, is my torturer. Brusa, it was my interrogator. Facino was the boss with the concentration camp. And Domingo Marcellini was the boss of all. Yes, because he's the graduate in the School of America.
Even though Patrici Sassa's torturers are in prison awaiting trial in Argentina, and the country's president has placed her in a witness protection program, Patricia continues to face death threats. But she refuses to be silent. Patricia tours the world, speaking out against human rights abuses. In 2006, she shared her story of survival before 25,000 protesters at the gates of the infamous School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, now named the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. The protesters demanded that the school for torturers be closed for good.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. Special thanks to Antonio Ortiz for production engineering. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music thanks to Abdelaziz, Abdellah, Mercedes Sosa, and Bruce Springsteen. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, senior producer Tina Rubio, Dorian Taylor, communications associate. Special thanks to Ron Rucker and Dan Turner. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.